At bottom, he was a decent sort, a simple, down-to-earth boy who would have shared all his worldly possessions with us, just as we shared ours with him, if only he had any. What will make this story heart-wrenching is Tevye's attraction to the force that's going to bring him down.
Professor Weiss, in this fourth lecture, we'll meet yet another of Tevye's daughters, Huddle. What do we know about her? What do we learn about her?
The first thing that we learn about Huddle is that she's studious, that she's actually a bookish girl. So this alerts us to something unexpected in Tevye's household. Girls in this society that still believed very strongly and practiced a division of labor according to one's gender, girls were expected to be intelligent and to work very hard, but basically they were expected to be working hard in the practical field of keeping a home. And here you have this girl who is a budding intellectual. What is going to happen to her? So that is one of the themes of the Huddle episode. And then, much more importantly than that, is whom Tevye meets this time. Again, there is a matchmaker. Who has a match in mind for him? A wealthy person, the kind of person whom Tevye might have chosen if he could have done the arranging. But at the same time, it's Tevye, interestingly, who meets this young man on the road, a young man who appeals to him tremendously, almost as if this young man were a younger version of himself. And he falls for him in his own way, and he says, hey, why don't you come home? And he's the one who brings him into the home. And of course, this is a time when the reader really understands that Tevye is doing something, whether subconsciously or really accidentally, but he is inviting trouble into his home because Perchik, the young man who shares some of his values, is indeed a revolutionary. So what this episode of Huddle has to do with is the way in which the Russian Revolution comes into Jewish life. Not so much the revolution itself as Marxism, the ideology of Marxism, the thought behind the revolution, how it confronts the traditional Jewish way of life.
Ruth, what are the themes that we're going to learn about in lecture number four?
Well, one of the themes is the continuing theme of men and women making their own choices and confronting the parents with the fact that they do so. They have autonomy of choice. And the other is the revolutionary theme. Here is radicalism really coming into Russian life and into Jewish life. And here is how it confronts the older generation. And then you have really Tevye, who has to respond to this, the degree to which he is sympathetic to some of the things that his children confront him with, and the part of him that knows that leniency has its limits. There are certain things in which he's not going to be able to participate. This is the first episode where we have a tragic ending. So by 1904, when Sholem Aleichem wrote Huddle, almost a decade after the first Tevye episode, the framework of this whole series was already, I think you see, firmly established. According to the fiction, when the writer decamps to his dacha in the summertime, he encounters the dairyman, who has by that time grown a little older and has something new to tell him. Well, these two men inhabit what the literary critic Boruch Rifkin called a Jewish territory made up of, as we said, the metropolis, the town, and the village that Sholem Aleichem endows with the Yiddish names Yehupitz, Anatevka, and Boybrik. And I added to this, I think that the two men constitute an ideal island of communication within that territory in Tsarist government Russia. the encounter between them gives Tevye the opportunity to pour out a story about some new crisis, some new problem, some new challenge to his way of life. In real life, the writer Sholem Rabinovich, who wrote under this pen name of Sholem Aleichem, turned to the character of Tevye whenever he was ready to confront what he perceived to be the latest crisis. And members of his family, including his brother-in-law, his son-in-law, Berkovich, who was himself a very distinguished writer, tell us that when Sholem Aleichem had written a new Tevye episode, he dressed up, and the family all dressed up, and they had a festive evening where he read this new episode to them all. So these were special occasions in the life of the writer. The Tevye story was a framework of two Jews talking within which any new problem could best be confronted. Sholem Aleichem was the writer who most ingeniously exploited the idiosyncrasies of the Yiddish language so that any threat to him as a writer would have been almost identical to whatever threatened Tevye as a Jew. Now, whether we call this a novel or a cycle of stories, it's the only such extended work of fiction that I know, as I've said before, that was written in real time over a period of 21 years. In that way, as you see, it doesn't have the usual structure of a novel in which a plot and subplots move toward a climax and then to a resolution. It's rather like variations on a theme, or like tides rolling in from the sea to crash on the shore and then retire until the next surge. And the repetitive rhythm of these stories reinforces the character of Tevye and underscores the stability of his relationship with Mr. Sholem Aleichem, because that keeps solid throughout from the first to the last episode, while at the same time it shows us how events eat away at their security. We begin to see Tevye aging perceptibly. The author was also aging at the same pace, and greater threat makes for more dramatic fiction. The story of Chava, which is the next story after this one, became in particular the nucleus of the play that Sholem Aleichem himself later extrapolated from the Tevye cycle, and it became the basis of all later Tevye adaptations. But from a literary point of view, some critics consider Huddle this the most perfect episode of the series. So that things have worsened appreciably in the 5 years between Seitel, 1899, and Huddle, 1904, is relayed in Tevye's greeting to his old friend. "You've been wondering, have you, Pani Sholem Aleichem, where I've been all this time? Tevye's changed quite a bit, you say? Grown suddenly gray? Ah, if only you knew the troubles, the heartache that I've been through. It is written that Odom Yesoidoi meofor, Vesoifoi leofor, that a man can be weaker than a fly and stronger than steel. I tell you, that's a description of me." As always, we see Tevye is playing with the text, this time on the teaching, man is but dust, and to dust he returns. So he keeps the structure of the saying, but he inverts the meaning to say that the human being may be weak, but he's also uncommonly strong. So he prepares us, I think, through this, for a story of strength in weakness. Tevye's allusion to the visible signs of aging suggests that what follows may be of a different order of seriousness than what we've been hearing until now. This would not have surprised contemporary readers. There had been pogroms in Russia since the 1880s, driving an ever-increasing number of Jews to America. But the pogrom in Kishinev in 1903 was like nothing before it, and it was the more stunning because it came at the beginning of a new century that many people had thought would usher in greater progress and peace. This was the first time that newspapers carried photographs of Jewish corpses, in the plural, and reports of rapes and ravage, bringing home the increasing violence that was being perpetrated against the Jews with some encouragement from the Russian government. So this story was written in the aftermath of Kishinev, although it does not yet mention that pogrom, that comes only later. And it was written at a time of great revolutionary ferment. Hoddle turns out to be one of the most consequential stories in Jewish literature for the way it confronts a new crisis that seemed so innocent at the time that you invited right into your home. There are certain threats that you can see coming and others that you can't. The pogroms are something that they didn't see coming, but that comes right at them from the outside. The crisis we see in this episode is something that you invite right into your home. And the story of Hoddle lies somewhere in between the crisis that comes from the outside and the crisis you don't see coming. It seems so benign, you almost welcome it. So, like most of the stories that Tevye tells, this one begins on the road, as he is on his way home from Boybrik, having sold a bit of merchandise, and as usual, he is thinking of the world's problems. But then I looked ahead and saw a young man trudging by the side of the path, a bundle under one arm, all sweaty and falling off his feet. "Hurry up, or you'll be late for the wedding," I called out to him. "Come to think of it, hop aboard. I'm going your way and my wagon is empty. You know what the Bible says. Help the jackass of your neighbor if you pass him on the road, and your jackass of a neighbor too." And of course, this from Exodus 23:5 says, "When you see the ass of your enemy lying under its burden and would refrain from lifting it, you must nevertheless lift it with him." So in the original, what does Tevye say? He greets the unknown young man with a phrase that pretends to be calling the bridegroom up to the reading of the Torah. What he says to him is, "Yamoida chosen Reb Yochel ben Fleckel." You say, "Yamoida chatan." And where does this come from? Halkin's translation, you see, has done something very clever. He picks up the reference to a marriage, "Hurry up or you'll be late for the wedding," that must come from somewhere in Tevye's subconscious. What gets Tevye to address this young man in that comical way that nevertheless refers to him as a bridegroom, right? So he has the marriage of his daughters on his mind. Tevye does not knowingly invite this young man to become his son-in-law, but he can't resist a younger and feistier version of himself. Notice how quickly and intimately these two men connect, right? He just sees him on the road. This time he doesn't wonder whether these are, monsters, yes, or the people who are going to befall him. He sees immediately what the kind of guy this is. And he knows that the young guy is Jewish, and he lets go with a joke that the boy appreciates, and he offers him a lift. And then they are off, sparring and enjoying the repartee. "Where are you coming from?" "Yehupetz." "What are you doing there?" "Preparing for the entrance exams." "What are you planning to study?" "Don't know yet." "In that case," I ask, "why is a young fellow like you beating his brains out?" "Don't you worry, Reb Tevye," he says. "A young fellow like me knows what he's doing." "Huh, tell me," I say, "since you seem to be a personal acquaintance of mine, just exactly who are you?" "Who am I?" he says. "A human being." "I already guessed as much," I said, "because you don't look like a horse to me." What I meant was, "Whose child are you?" "Whose child?" he says. "I'm a child of God's." As the dialogue continues, we learn, after all, that he is Perchik, the cigarette maker's son, that he is an ideologue, and that he has a real chip on his shoulder. Tevye no sooner grants Perchik that he has as much right to study as the rich Jews of Yehupetz than our young man really erupts. "Those Jews," he says, will never live to see the day when I'll be like them. I'll see them all in hell first. Oh, why, bless my soul, if you don't seem to have something against them, I say. I hope they haven't gone and put a lien on your father's estate. It's their estates, he says, that will be yours and mine and everyone's someday. You know what, I say, I'd leave that sort of talk to your worst enemies. I can see one thing, though, and that's that with a tongue like yours, you're in no danger of getting lost in the shuffle. If you're free tonight, why don't you drop over? We can chat a bit and have some supper while we're at it. So Tevye is uncomfortable with the boy's belligerent language, but he also invites him to drop over for a meal that evening. Take care, the reader says to himself, remembering what happened when Tevye invited Menachem Mendel into his home. And Tevye has told us about Hodel's interest in books. He has a daughter who is susceptible to ideas, right? So we are also aware, if we are the readers of Shalom Aleichem's time, and by this time, if you are an educated reader, you're aware of the revolutionary movement gathering force in Russia, and we realize that Perchik is involved with it and what is likely to happen. Were Tevye a more calculating man, we might suspect him of deliberately engineering this romance. But it is more complicated than that, because Tevye cannot knowingly support anyone who wants to subvert his way of life. Perchik echoes some of Tevye's complaints about the unfair disparity between rich and poor, but unlike Tevye, he intends to level those differences. So Tevye responds to what they have in common, and he willingly overlooks the part that he doesn't like. This young man is about as close to Tevye will ever get to having a son of his own. So he invites Perchik for his own pleasure, but who really knows what lies in, what mysteries dwell in the hearts and minds of people. And we have to, when we read this, read this amazing interchange between this person, these two men, you see, it's all about dialogues between people in this work, but we see this kind of dialogue, how different it is from the others, the degree to which they really appreciate one another. But I think that one sees what's on the horizon.
Do you see this as a problem that those who value the intellectual life, in a way, they're susceptible to this problem? Because, as you say, it's Tevye who's excited by the ideas of Perchik, invites him in, not because of his Marxist socialist leanings, but because he likes discussing ideas with him at the table.
Yes. I think that the intellect behind this, the way in which Marxism actually appealed to the mind, has a lot to do with it. But I would not discount the theme of the Tevye stories from the very beginning. When we first meet Tevye, he's already alerted to the unfairness of the tremendous gap that had grown between the wealthy and the poor, partly as a result of Tsarist policy that really forced this gap. In other words, by allowing rich Jews to live in the large cities and by not giving poorer Jews permission to compete on an equal footing with their fellow Jews, so that this economic disparity, which had begun to exist in Jewish life, where it had never existed in that form before, I think that this is one of the things that really bothered Tevye from the very beginning. And here is a young man who really takes this to a much more radical level. And so both those things, I think, are of great appeal to Tevye. So because the reader at this point knows more than Tevye does about Perchik's ideology and already anticipates what Tevye doesn't yet suspect, the scene is rich in what we would call dramatic irony that keeps getting thicker as Tevye continues with his story. Dramatic irony arises when the audience or the reader knows more than the character, when the full significance of a speaker's words or actions is clearer to the audience or to the reader than it is to the speaker himself. Perchik is focused on class conflict, but what emerges in this story is a widening conflict between young Jews like him and a Jew like Tevye. This breach, this divergence, is conveyed through dramatic irony as we understand more and more, while Tevye seems to want to notice less and less. These two Jews wonderfully speak the same Yiddish language. They love speaking the same language. Yiddish is the language of the proletariat. But instead of quoting from Jewish texts, Perchik spouts revolutionary slogans. He strips away the religious layer of the language, having no use for the Jewish past. Dramatic irony alerts us to how far they are apart while seeming to be in almost perfect accord. So 1904, the year of this story, was a very decisive year in the history of the Russian revolutionary movement, with some 2 million Russians engaged in anti-Tsarist strikes and protests. Perchik is part of that movement. But Tevye doesn't take that side of him quite seriously. He sees this peppercorn, this peppery young man, becoming a member of the household because, he writes, at bottom, he was a decent sort, a simple, down-to-earth boy who would have shared all his worldly possessions with us, just as we shared ours with him, if only he had any. What will make this story heart-wrenching is Tevye's attraction to the force that's going to bring him down. Tevye admires Peppercorn as an idealist without recognizing the threat that he poses. So it may be worth noting that a couple of years after this story, Sholem Aleichem also wrote a novel about that revolutionary period, a novel called In the Storm, that takes us into the heart of the action. The characters of that novel, which by the way is available in English translation, they are all young Jews from the same town who have moved to St. Petersburg to attend the university. The girls are drawn into the revolutionary movement, interestingly, while the boy, the young man in the book, is a Zionist who's drawn into the Zionist movement. And written from and from the perspective of the young, the book reaches its climax on Bloody Sunday, the day in January 1905 when Father Gapon, a Russian Orthodox priest, led a march to the Winter Palace to present Tsar Nicholas II with a petition demanding a new constitution for Russia. The guards fired on the unarmed demonstrators, and some historians believe that the sequence of events resulting from this bloodbath eventually culminated in the decisive revolution of 1915. But in the meantime, it was the revolution of 1905 that was called the Russian Revolution. And by the way, one of the Jewish girls in Sholem Aleichem's novels is killed in the action. So if we were looking for an easy read, a romantic plot against a historical background, we would be reading In the Storm, which is also, as I say, available to us. But no one would mistake that book for a classic or want to devote a course to its study. And if you want to test me out on this, I invite you to do it and perhaps see the difference between these two works, right? So Huddle presents the same revolutionary momentum from what may seem to us the narrower and less exciting perspective of a father who doesn't fully grasp what's going on. Yet readers from that time to this are captivated by how the revolution creeps up on Tevye. His free association and his associative style give us access to the mind of a terribly ambivalent Jew. If he cannot be an actor in history, how is he going to respond to unwelcome events? He believes in the young man's idealism. He fears what this means for his family and for Jewishness, and he knows better than to trust harebrained schemes. So the story that he tells develops in very intertwined ways, all kinds of themes: generational conflict, youth and experience, love and loyalty, the particular and the universal, secularism and religion, conservative and liberal, or conservative and radical, and their approaches to history. And we're going to be able to open up only a small part of this for discussion, but there is much, much that can be extrapolated from this story. So let's begin with the romance. Tevye is, as always, approached by a matchmaker, since, as I said, he is the father of marriageable daughters. The father wants for his daughter what he considers a good marriage. Tevye has evolved since the episode of Zeitl, when the matchmaker asks him to run Hoddle down to Boiberich. Tevye balks. He says, "Run my daughter down to Boiberich? Do you think she's a horse being brought to the fair?" Nice, right? He has in mind that mistaken exchange about Zeitl and the cow, and he no longer treats his daughter as a product that a father can bring to market. And then when he sees Hoddle and Perchik coming out of the forest, he realizes pretty quickly what's going on between the two of them, and maybe some of his anger at not having been asked for permission acknowledges that he has no one to blame but himself. And if we remember, the author Sholem Rabinovich and his student Olga Loyev decided to marry, and they also confronted in her father an angry employer who was angriest of all that the couple had not informed him of what was going on right under his nose. So here Sholem Aleichem, who was once in the position of the young suitor, tells the story from the point of view of the ambivalent father. He now identifies with Tevye more than he does with Perchik. Right? The story is told, as we say, who controls the narrative? Story is told from the perspective of the father. Now, love. This story is amazingly swaddled in love. Hoddle was probably attracted to Peppercorn by some of the same qualities that endeared this young man to Tevye. When the couple tells Tevye what they are planning, Hoddle says, "Papa, you don't know how happy it makes us to finally tell you the truth. It's such a load off our minds. Come, let me give you a kiss." And before I know it, she grabs me from one side, he grabs me from the other, and we all begin to kiss so hard that pretty soon they're kissing each other. A scene from the theater, I tell you. "Don't you think that's enough for a while?" I finally managed to say. "It's time we had a practical talk." So we can picture this comic scene where the struggle between the father and the prospective son-in-law seems so cheerfully resolved. They all love one another. Father and daughter truly love one another. Boy and girl truly love one another. And Tevye and Perchik truly love one another. It's not one of those angry, intransigent father stories after all. But were there not so much love, there would be less grief. If Tevye were angry and aggrieved, if Hoddle were angry and rebellious, if Perchik were hostile and exultant at gaining the upper hand, the break would be bitter rather than heart-wrenching. This trio does not want to confront the fact that Hoddle has chosen one love over another, and that her two loves and loyalties are not compatible, as they are when parents accompany their children to the chuppah and the children continue to love and honor their parents while clinging to their spouses. By choosing Perchik, Hoddle marries and accepts the way of life of someone who is leaving the Jewish people, and neither of them will ever return to it. So everyone in this story would rather avoid the implications of the break by emphasizing their affection for one another. But Perchik has inducted Hoddle into what is essentially a new system of belief, a new religion, we might say. The revolutionary movement is in every way radical, which is to say, tearing the society up from its roots. And radical, as you know, is from the Latin word radix, the root. And this is tearing it up from the root. They feel that the revolution comes in the name of self-sacrifice and love, purporting to fight the injustice of Russia without admitting that it was also subverting Jewish life from within. Now, communication here is consequently much more problematic than it was with Zeitl and Mottl. It is shrouded in secrecy, and it fails to connect. The trouble is you don't understand is at the heart of the exchanges between Hoddle and her father. And Tevye realizes how backward he seems to his daughter. When he sees the Jewish youngsters dressed more like Russians than Jews, he thinks Perchik may be part of a gang of highway murderers. Hoddle explains that these Kasrilovki youngsters are the best, the finest, the most honorable people in the world, and that they live their whole lives for others, never giving a fig for their own skins. Tevye mocks the group that has captured her loyalty, but does Hoddle get it? Does she get his mockery? Tevye says, not my Hoddle, ein Esther Magedes, see no evil, hear no evil. Now this is really a double meaning, a phrase used with double meaning. Because of her beauty and brains, Tevye often associates Hoddle with Esther, the heroine of the Book of Esther, who helps save the Jews from Haman's wicked designs. The phrase that he quotes here comes from the point in the story when Esther has just been appointed queen, but Esther still did not reveal her kindred or her people. Ain Esther Magedes. She's not squealing. She's not talking. She didn't tell anyone that she was a Jew. If Tevye does not understand Hoddle, she is even less capable of understanding his humor. He knows that Hoddle is not concealing her Jewishness in order to come to the rescue of the Jews, but she is concealing her revolutionary intentions because the prospect of world liberation seems to her more urgent than familial or national loyalty. Tevye understands the cultural and political implications of her indifference to being Jewish. Love or no love, she has transferred her allegiance to an alternate faith. She does not know what he knows. He does not know what she knows. And they will part on that basis. So, a love story. But this love story is also about the inroads of communism into modern Jewish life. And here is something truly noteworthy, right? It's instructive that Sholem Aleichem did not make Perchik, as he could have done, a member of the Jewish Socialist Bund, the movement that tried to integrate Marxism with Jewish nationalism and defined Yiddish as the language of the proletariat, and therefore really made an ideological ally of Yiddish. Had Perchik been a Bundist, he might very well have been arrested for insurrection against the Tsar, and, you know, several thousand Jewish Bundists, I think almost 5,000 Jewish Bundists were arrested and sent to camps like the one that that Perchik is sent to in the year 1904. But he would have been arrested as a Jew had he been a Bundist. Had Sholem Aleichem made Perchik a Bundist, that would have represented Jewish socialism as a kind of halfway house, a possible answer to the struggle between two competing sets of loyalties. And of course, the Jewish Socialist Bund that was founded presented itself in precisely that way, that we are an amalgam of Marxism and Judaism. And that is how we will go forth in history, reconciling these two things. But Sholem Aleichem did not want to split the difference. He presents them as irreconcilable. It's clear from their dress and their bearing that Perchik's Jewish buddies have joined an all-Russian unit, and that they are arrested and exiled not as Jews, but as Russian revolutionaries. Tevye confronts an irresoluble conflict that is painful because these young Jews, one's own flesh and blood, are moving out. They are not body snatchers or highway robbers, but persons with otherwise praiseworthy ideals who are nevertheless launched on a course that will probably not end well for them and that will certainly not end well for the Jewish people. The difference cannot be split because Moses and Marx, the Jewish way of life and the communist project, are different in kind. Now, Sholem Aleichem, in his life and in his writing, always faced it. They were different in kind. And this is one of the things that made him, you see, the revolutionary movements, the Bund especially, when they needed a speaker, they often turned to Sholem Aleichem because he was the most popular writer and he could fill a hall. But the young, the revolutionaries, did not appreciate Sholem Aleichem. To him, he was what he is, really. They could see this conservative tendency that some of you here have noted, right? And here you see the degree to which Tevye is attracted, and yet the degree to which he understands that this is something different. All the while that Tevye describes his failure to really understand what Perchik is up to and how Hoddle is keeping him in the dark, he's really telling us something of the opposite, that he understands, that he may understand something about life that is more than what they understand. And he may be a better long-range guide to survival. How flexible and lively his mind is compared to their rigid focus on the future. He speaks in so many registers, right? And nothing he says is ever as simple as what they say or fail to say. He moves from ancient sources to Ukrainian sayings, bringing centuries of Jewish experience to bear on contemporary events. And he is remarkably adaptive. And with this fourth episode, I think we begin to realize that Tevye really is our hero, not the ones who are bringing change, like Menachem Mendel, like Mottl, like Perchik, not even the independent daughters who are standing up for themselves, but the man telling us the story. This is what it means, I think, to command the narrative, to infuse the story with your moral vision, no matter what that story may be. The resolution or denouement of this story comes in the autumn, when Boyberik's summer people return to town and the seasonal business stops. There is a lull in the action at that point, and this may be the first time that we see Tevye relaxing. He says, "It's my favorite season. Each day is a gift. The sun's not as hot as an oven anymore and has a mildness about it that makes being out of doors a pleasure. The leaves are still green, the pine trees give off a good tarry smell, and the whole forest is looking at its best, as if it were God's own sukkah, a tabernacle for God. It's there that he must celebrate the holiday, not in the city where there's such a commotion of people running about to earn their next meal and thinking only of money, of how to make more and more of it." So Tevye is as relaxed, and it's also because he has never seen Hoddle in recent days this happy. He seems to think that she has received good news. And indeed, she seems cheerier than she has been since Perchik disappeared to where he will not say. As he thinks of her, as Tevye thinks of his daughter, she comes out to join him. But for him, the news is not so good. "Papa, I have to tell you something. I'm saying goodbye to you tonight forever." For some reason, this makes Tevye think that she may want to drown herself. A weird thought, and he knows it. So he's almost relieved when she says that she is just going away in the morning and will never see him again. Of course, she cannot tell him where or why. Dramatic irony again. Everyone knows what Tevye doesn't. Perchik has been convicted. He has been exiled to a penal colony. And in the kindlier times of Tsar Nicholas, wives were allowed to join their husbands in these prison colonies. So Hoddle is being sent there to Siberia, into the Gulag, as it came to be known, and she is leaving home, indeed, never to return. So we should never underestimate Tevye's subconscious. He fears that Hoddle is going to commit suicide. And in a sense, she is. He is powerless to stop her with arguments, and he's not about to stop her by force. So he must adjust to his loss, as we have by now seen him adjust to other losses. Though this one is, as I said, of the pogrom in Kishinev, this loss is of another order of magnitude. Tevye's eloquence fails him when he tries to describe the parting from Hoddle. Just see how this amazing speaker, see what he says as he's recounting this. "Please forgive me, Pani, if I, just like a woman, but I want you to know what a Hoddle I have. You should see the letters she writes me. She's God's own Hoddle, Hoddle is, and she's with me right here all the time, deep, deep down. There's no way to put it into words." If Tevye cannot put it into words, that would be the end of Tevye, because words are the way he integrates life, and they are the way, they are what he lives for. Happily, he does recover his speech, and he sums up this parting with the most famous tagline in Yiddish literature. "You know what, Pani Sholem Aleichem? Let's talk about something more cheerful. Have you heard any news of the cholera in Odessa?" Now, this became one of the most famous taglines in Jewish speech. You cannot imagine how often Yiddish speakers or anyone growing up in this tradition, when you're at a bad moment in time, you say, "You know what? Let's talk about something more cheerful. What do you know about the cholera epidemic in Odessa?" Something. This has really become a kind of trope. So Tevye recovers his equilibrium through this black humor. If his humor has grown dark, it's because the stakes are now higher than before and the circumstances are considerably worse. So Jewish folklore tells us that Soros Rabim Chetzi Nechome, common distress is half a consolation. An epidemic elsewhere is also easier to bear than personal agony. Odessa was a large Jewish center, always good for a laugh, and life being what it is easier to think about thousands dying of illness there than to face the absence of Hoddle in his life. Mel Brooks puts it this way: "Tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die." Same kind of thing, right? The cholera epidemic in Odessa is the comic antidote to the tragedy of Hoddle's departure. The humor is the way Tevye maintains his equilibrium, and it's the way that Sholem Aleichem restores the balance of the hard-hit Jewish people. So this is, you see, the second challenge that Tevye faces through his daughters, a challenge that includes many of the elements of the Zeitl episode, the element of love, of the woman making her own decision, of children choosing their own path and determining their own partners in life. Those things are common. But at this point, you see also the escalation. What Hoddle is leaving for is not Motel, who wants pretty much the same thing as Tevye always wanted, to live the same way of life with just slightly altered values. No, this is the revolution. And so all of this, I think, is quite remarkable. And the part of it that really is most important for us to consider is when it came at that very early point, we feel in this story, we're allowed to feel in this story, how attractive it was and why young people might feel that this is their idealism that grows naturally out of the words that Tevye has said in his prayers. It grows so close to what Tevye has been asking God for. It has so much, it seems to have so much in common with wanting to overthrow the wicked Tsar and to make life more equitable for everybody. So many things in it seem to be the kinds of things that you would invite into your home, as Tevye does, ultimately to face this scene of parting.
What are some of the things that we should have in mind to take away from it?
I think that one of the things that one can see here is that this is one of the earliest and most penetrating studies of how Marxism really affected Jewish life. It's a huge subject for the historian, And we know that historians have had to deal with it. Even before the Soviet Union was formed and so many millions of Jews became part of the Soviet system. But here you begin to see in an incipient way how the revolution penetrated Jewish life, how it challenged it. You see it here in its mildest form because Tevye the father is still very sympathetic to this movement. He doesn't yet face the implications fully, but the author of the story, who is actually the creator of Tevye, alerts us by the way in which the story develops and particularly by the way the story ends, what it means for Perchik and Hodel to be leaving at the end. And she says, I am leaving forever. She will never be back.
Seems like so much of the pathos introduced into this part of the story is due to the fact that Tevye himself invites Perchik into the family.
Yes, this is precisely it. The degree of sympathy that he has for this movement is manifest in this story. And so this is, I would say, the most important part of the story, is that it comes into Jewish life, as Shalom Aleichem represents it to us, not as an enemy, but it comes in really as if it was a natural part of Jewish experience. The Jewish experience was always kind of open to these questions, and that Marx presented them, you know, and many Jews tried to present them as being entirely compatible with the Jewish position. Though Marx saw the dichotomy between what he was proposing, between his economic analysis of life and the Jewish, the religious way of life, he saw the differences between them. There were many Jews who wanted to see and who made a great effort of reconciling these two things because they said, wait a minute, cannot this be seen as a fulfillment of Judaism? After all, if we're working for a more egalitarian society, is this not something that Judaism was pointing to all along? So it's in that spirit almost that Tevye innocently invites this force into his life.
But of course, as you say, Shalom Aleichem renders a different judgment in the end by having his daughter, in a way, disconnected from the family forevermore.
Yes, and that is why this may be the most tragic of these stories. I mean, it has a lot to compete with as we go along,
right.
But in a sense, the ending here is really the most bitterly tragic ending.